Do you know that in all the primordial Americas, there were only two blood types? All of the Indians of the Americas, there are only two blood types. One blood type covers all of the Americas. I believe it's blood type A, and then there's a blood type AB, which is in the northern part of North America, which shows that there were two successive immigrations, one of them about 12,000 years ago, and one of them about 25,000 years ago. But almost all of the Indians of the Americas could have blood transfusions with each other. And in ancient times, they considered it a unity. And the land is used to having human beings considered a unity. And the last 200 years have just been a growing nightmare for the land. Eventually, we will have a single planet, but to consider the Americas as an integrity is one giant step towards it. So next year, at the Esalen Institute, we're going to have a conference on the esoteric core of the Americas, and we mean business, mean to do it. Let me remind you that we're going to be using Jung next week. So if you haven't read your Jung, Alchemical Studies, please. At this late date, get your copy of Alchemical Studies. And we portioned out the five chapters in Alchemical Studies, the five sections, to various people. And I'm going to count on you people to help give an explication. It's important that as you learn in this kind of a teaching mode, that you also become capable of teaching others yourself. So at the same time that you're learning from me, you're learning to teach others. And there shouldn't be very much of a lag behind that. By very much of a lag, I mean something like, say, 3 months at the most. So that what you're learning here 3 months later, you should be able to have some sense of how to tell someone else. There's that kind of a situation. And the program is designed to free human beings, give them an education which frees them, which allows them to have the competence in themselves. We've got one generation left to put the power of decision into the minds and hearts of the people of the world, because all the other power structures are going to collapse. And if there are people, then we can do whatever needs to be done. But if we're dependent like cripples on some hierarchies, then we're going to be in a hell of a mess. There aren't any power structures that are existent now that are going to survive another 20 years. None of them. You might look forward a little bit here. In order to articulate each of the sections, each of the eight sections, we have a week of an interval nature, which ostensibly has nothing to do with what went before and nothing to do with what comes after, but has everything to do with the overall context. And the key for the interval after this section on magic is Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi is one of the great first-class spirits of our world. And I want to use a particular little treatise of his, a mystical treatise, which is translated into English and is available. It's called Journey to the Lord of Power. I notice this is misspelled here. Journey to, not to the land of power, to the Lord. Lord of power. Journey. This is a classic journey of the soul. Classic journey of the soul. And the journey of the soul always has stages. But the stages are only there as an objective purpose. When you achieve those stages, they are no longer stages, but they become phases. As soon as you achieve a stage, it becomes a phase. As soon as you get to where you thought you were going to be, it becomes a new level of going, a new level of continuing. So the transformation of the purpose and the stage into yet another phase is the very essence of esoteric journeying. And Ibn Arabi is one of the greatest guides in the world for being conscious of having this sense of transformational journeying. And his journey to the Lord of Power, even though it's short and small, has all of the concise power of this great Sufi teacher. He is just incredibly capable and competent. And we can trust ourselves at this particular juncture. This is a very strong juncture, and Ibn Arabi will help take us here. The translation I'm using is by Sheikh Ozak al-Tirahi, and it's available in paperback from Inner Traditions. We have a copy here, and I'm sure that no one's going to complain if we Xerox a few copies for our own use. The translators and publishers won't mind, and I assure you that Ibn Arabi would not mind at all. He sends us love and kisses. The next section is on art, and we're going to be making some art. But I have to emphasize to you, art is the capacity of person making also. The most graphic occurrence when you have art is that there is an artist. It's so fundamental that we tend to overlook it, and yet it is the fundamental reality of art, that there is an artist. It's the old classic aesthetic judgment problem. How do we know that such and so is a work of art? The first and only point of judgment as to its form is the artist. When the artist says that it's done, it's done. And it's not that it's achieved some kind of final perfection. Faulkner once said that every writer realizes late in his life that he hasn't been able to do it and then breaks his pencil and stops writing. But it's like, in its time, this was the best that one could have done, and it's complete in that sense, that its expression is as good as it can be for what it is. And one of the signs of an artist is that he knows that one work, the activities of one work, are different from the activities of a different work. It's one of the great capacities of an artist to know when he has two works that are needing separation. Two, he's doing a painting and he realizes that there are two paintings in this. Or he's working with wood or some other sculptural medium, and he realizes that he's confusing two sculptures. Or like a writer who's writing, and he realizes that the reason why the poem is not coming out is that there are two poems in here. There's a tremendous spiritual capacity to know that, and that's what makes an artist. That's what makes really a person, to know that what you are doing belongs to this life, and that these other activities may be masks or roles that you can don from time to time given various conditions. You might be given the condition where you have to direct several hundred people from the 50th floor, and you assume a role accordingly. But woe unto you if you can't discern that the requirements of that role may have nothing to do with the life that you really have. And it shouldn't impair your ability to function in roles to have the life that really is yours, to have some sense of what really belongs to this life and shape that life in its integrity. An actor like Alec Guinness has played many roles, and he's still very much Alec Guinness. It's like that sort of thing. So art has this tone of person-making. So when we come to work with materials, I have chosen four artists who were exceedingly fine at this kind of resolution. We're going to begin with a classical Greek artist, Euripides. And we're going to begin with Euripides' last tragedy. He wrote it when he was 70 years old. He wrote it in exile. And it was the last thing he ever wrote. And he put every capacity that he had, which were considerable, into the tragedy. And the tragedy is the Bacchae. And the Bacchae is one of the great works of the human spirit. Its themes are God and madness, and we need to know. So get a copy of the Bacchae. There are many translations of this. I've never seen a bad translation of the Bacchae. They all work. I'll use five or six different ones, so it doesn't really matter. So any translation of the Bacchae by Euripides. The second work that you must have, you must go and buy this, a paperback, it's about $2. It's by one of the great artists of our time, Kandinsky, Vasily Kandinsky. And the title is Concerning the Spiritual in Art. And Kandinsky wrote it in 1912. He had just left his Russia, had not accepted the Germany he was in fully, but he was in a no man's land, and yet he was himself, and he was very capable. By 1912, Kandinsky was extremely capable. And Kandinsky is the most intellectual of all the esoteric art, great artists of the 20th century. His teaching capacities were phenomenal and renowned. He taught at several places. But Kandinsky's Concerning the Spiritual in Art is extremely important for us. The third volume is a selection of writings by Frank Lloyd Wright. And Frank Lloyd Wright was really a builder. He was an architect. He could compose structure in his insight. Not many people have that capacity. It's a very rare capacity. Michelangelo had that capacity. Leonardo da Vinci had that capacity. Frank Lloyd Wright had. He could compose in his insight. He could, while looking at a situation, compose whatever resolution form he wished for that situation. And I guess one of the classic examples of that is his home that he built for the Kaufman family, Falling Water. And he saw that home the first time he went to that site. He saw it in his mind's eye, creatively, and he was able to unfold it. It takes several years for architecture to happen, minimally several years. But he saw it just like Mozart would hear a symphony before he would write a single note down. We have a letter from him someplace about the composition of the Jupiter Symphony, number 41, and Mozart said that writing it down was easy. In fact, his manuscripts are just a blur because he wrote so fast, because he'd already heard the whole symphony in his musical mind. This thing of piecing together notes is composition by committee. But there are great artists who are incredibly great, and Frank Lloyd Wright is one of those individuals. And in his writings, we'll get an insight into how geometricity structures a kind of a kinesthetic integrity. Frank Lloyd Wright's word for it was continuity. He said the reality of a building is the space of the building. And what makes the building right for man is that that space have continuity. That no matter where you are in that building, you're in that building. He said in the same essay, I'm out to destroy the box as a home for man, because people who live in boxes are fodder for fascist ideals. And if we destroy the box, we'll free man, and he'll never have to fit in someone else's cases again. So, writings by Frank Lloyd Wright, the selection that I like, I think, is available still. It was originally published by Meridian Books. Hennessy and Engels, Art and Architecture Bookstore in Santa Monica, are fanatics about Wright, and they have just about everything by him in numerous quantities. But I think Writings and Buildings by Frank Lloyd Wright should be available. If not, we can make some Xeroxes here. So Euripides, Kandinsky, Frank Lloyd Wright, and the fourth person I'm going to use is Henry Moore. Henry Moore is tremendously capable, and we need to have the art of sculpture included. And I don't know if I can work this, but maybe I can get you a little look-see at a sculpture studio. My neighbor next door, my friend Dave, is a sculptor, pretty good sculptor. And maybe when we get to Henry Moore, we might be able to get a look. Dave is building a 40-foot sculpture in Pasadena on Lake Street in front of one of those new high-rise buildings. It'll be, the largest sculpture in the West Coast. He's pretty capable. But with Henry Moore, I want to use a particular volume, if you can find it, a volume by Eric Neumann, who was a friend and disciple of Carl Jung, who taught at the University of Tel Aviv for many, many years. And Eric Neumann's The Archetypal World of Henry Moore is the book I'd like to use. If you recall, Eric Neumann was extremely attentive to trying to understand the relationship between the psychology of a woman and the archetype of the Great Mother. And he wrote a book called The Great Mother, which is maybe 600-700 pages. It's in paperback from Princeton University Press. And the parallel book to The Great Mother is about the archetype. But the human dilemma that comes out of that is in his book on a study of Apuleius, you know, the golden ass of Apuleius, a story out of that called Amor and Psyche. And also published by Princeton is a little paperback, Amor and Psyche. And Neumann's Amor and Psyche is extremely insightful into the dynamics of a woman's existential, personal reality. Not the kind of phony, projected, second-hand, masculinizing the feminine. The idea of the feminine is interesting intellectually, but being a woman in your own person is a real existential quandary. And Neumann's Amor and Psyche addresses itself to that quandary, not to the idea of the feminine so much. So we'll use Henry Moore via Eric Neumann, we'll use Frank Lloyd Wright, we'll use Kandinsky, and we'll use Euripides. And of course, you'll be doing some art for yourself, and I can tell you that some of the people who have been through this here have had some interesting experiences. Now, one of the bridges from magic to art is to make language, to use magical language conscientiously. And the key to that bridge is poetry. Poetry. So preparatory to doing the art, while we're still in the magic section, I want you all to try and write some poetry. But I want it to be as condensed a poetry as possible, and the most condensed form of poetry in the Treasury of the World's examples are haiku. So I want you to be writing some haiku. And that's why Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North is so important. His Oko no Hosomichi is the context in which one understands how haiku functions. That language is a kind of samurai flash of the sword. Only instead of flashing the sword, one flashes the insight in language. And it's a Zen moment. So I hope that some of you have copies of Basho. Any books on haiku will help. But from now on, try to sensitize yourself by composing a haiku every now and then. I don't say every day, but if you need some direction, do it every day. But for the next month or so, we want to and save all these. And what we'll do is collect and have typed up all of the haiku that we write. And we'll copy them off, and everybody will get a sheaf of haiku from the people here. Your experience is extremely valuable and important. And though I try to use the cream of the cream of the world's tradition, it's important for us to understand that what we do here is extremely valuable, worth saving, worth cherishing. So save your haiku, and I hope that you have at least 20 or 25 or 30 haiku by the time we get to them in a month. This is the beginning of April, or March, so about the beginning of April. We'll want to get to the haiku about the time that the art section begins. One last thing. The interval going between magic and art, I use Ibn Arabi because of his nature of being able to show how the stage becomes a phase. At the end of the art section, I'm going to use the most insightful of all the 20th century poets. I'm going to use Rainer Maria Rilke. And of Rilke's works, I've found that the Sonnets to Orpheus is the best. So if you're looking a little bit ahead, in 4 months we'll be getting to Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. So that art will be articulated between Ibn Arabi and Rilke. And the tone of those two together is exactly the tone that I would wish to convey to you about art. That it has its lonely, esoteric aspect, but it also has its communal, joyous aspect. And part of the beauty of the communal joy is that we know how precarious that is, but that it's founded on the aloneness and the esotericness makes it real. Otherwise, we would come to mistrust all joyous communal experiences in this world. We would eventually, like old hardened ascetics, just come to see it as pure illusion and to throw it away. But we cannot throw the world away, we cannot throw life away, and we cannot throw human beings away. So we have to amend what was a characteristic of the wisdom tradition for thousands and thousands of years. We have to show to ourselves that the appearances are worth saving. Sure, they're appearances, but they are worth saving. They're worth cherishing. Even though they're like, I guess the haiku vision, even though they're like the snowflakes or the flowers in the field, they're not going to last. It doesn't make them any less beautiful, and it doesn't make our experience of them any less poignant. We have to remind ourselves consciously of that now. The great enemy of man is forgetfulness, and the first things that are forgotten are these little seeming inconsequential beauties of this world. One last thing, if you're following the broad structure, you'll be reading through this whole year of 1989 either the Canterbury Tales or the Odyssey by Homer. It's important to link the entire year's experience together, and to do that we need some large form of journeying, and Chaucer and Homer are two pretty good guides, two pretty good companions for that. So if you have started one or the other in January, I will next week give you some assigned sections to help focus your reading experience. Other than that, you should read them in your own pace in your own time. They're unifying threads which should take about a year, really, to read the Canterbury Tales or the Odyssey. If you read it with any kind of conscientiousness, it should take about a year. But these things were not meant to be read like novels in 2 days, but to take your time. And of course, the best way is to read them out loud. I have for many years read sections out loud of large works, and my particular family we're just used to doing this now. And every year we read something, and read it. It doesn't matter if it's just a few pages in a night, or 5 or 6 pages a week. As long as you just continue to do it, it has its unifying thread. So you can see how much is going on here, and if you're following it with any kind of continuity, you should be able to sense some sea changes in your life. Your capacities for experiencing should be more wholesome than they were. Now to the art of memory. We have in the magic section this volume by Frances Yates, The Art of Memory. Now I had thought to use her book, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, but it's so difficult to find it around, and really it requires, this book requires a lot of intellectual background. And I think later on in your own time, you might go through a volume like this. The important aspect is that you understand what the wisdom tradition has been, at least in general outline, in general sense. It's important to understand that there has always been a wisdom tradition, that our forebears and our ancestors have been extremely conscientious and intelligent about the world and about life. They understood what was important and how to keep it alive and how not to lose it. The fact that we are here as we are is really a proof of the pudding. We would never be on this high point of this mountain had we have not been put there by our forebears. we are in a very interesting position. We're just about ready to be able to get born out into the cosmos, and that's really something. The tradition centers around the use of memory. In other words, you cannot have a tradition. You cannot have any kind of lineage of understanding without memory. Just to have imagination is not enough. The imagination has to be structured. Now, the very first structure that imagination receives is a symbolic shape, symbolic capacity. Symbols shape images. But in the shaping process, the images are not only brought into a pattern, but the meaning of the images is woven into the pattern, so that symbols not only have images, but they have ideas. But the ideas are tremendously magnetic. It's just as the images are electrical, the ideas are magnetic, so that symbols generate an electromagnetic field, as it were, quite real. Neural energy is an electromagnetic field generated by the symbolic self. Before a human being is able to symbolize, they're a very weak field. And when they acquire a symbolic center, when it becomes energized, when it becomes there, already you see a jump in capacity. You can see it in children. You can see them come into their I-ness. And just so, a person who finds consciously their integrity generates a much, much stronger field. Now, it can be expressed symbolically as an aura, or it can be expressed in an existential tone as a quality of life. Someone who is charismatic, or someone who is effective. All sorts of ways to be expressed. It's the symbol, the symbolic capacity, or as Jung used the term, the symbolic life, that brings images and ideas together. But the ideational dynamic radiates the images back out, so that the images, when they're brought into the self, have a kind of a mythic quality, like dreams. But when the images are radiated out, they have a magical quality, like visions. And it's just the difference between dream and vision that indicates the power of the self. Now, this has always been the case, and so it's always been incumbent on those who would restructure the understanding of wisdom for their own time to go back and review the traditions and review this most important and arcane of all transformations, and then give a new way of magically, consciously envisioning the world and possibilities. Now, in the book that I'm writing on Jesus in Alexandria, the person who performed that was the Teacher of Righteousness. And the textbook that he wrote about the first half of the second century BC, the Book of Daniel. The Book of Daniel is a workbook, a manual of how to take the dream interpretive capacity and empower it with the visionary capacity. And while the first part of the Book of Daniel is all about dream interpretation and the ways in which it is done, the last part is how an apocalyptic vision is able to be understood. Not in terms of someone's interior dream, but in terms of the of the large-scale life happenings in the future. So if you're interested in that, I gave 7 lectures in the series last year at the Philosophic Research Society, and I think I have that pegged pretty closely. It'll be the second chapter in this book on repositioning the figure of Jesus in history. So memory, remembering who you are, is the very essence of that magical capacity. The very essence of consciousness is remembering who you are. But if you try to force some image of yourself that you remember who you are in terms of that image, some favorite image that you have, that's egotism. Because your deep self is not one particular image. It's all the images that went into making you up, plus all of the meaningful ideas that generate out of that, so that the symbolic self is protean. And to try and force one image is a form of tyranny, self-imposed tyranny. To try and be, say, well, my ego is thus and so, and only that, and everything else is different from me, this is childish instead of childlike. And of course, the world cannot accept that, and other people cannot accept that. There's no tie between that phony, forced, artificial self. And so those artificial selves that are the egos are not what we're talking about. But that deep self, which is very accurately who we are. It's like some of you are taking in the Upanishad series that I'm doing on Thursday night. It's like behind the secret of self-realization is following the sense patterns out into their objects, into the world. Not trying to stop sensation, not trying to snip those ties, but one in a deep meditative strategy follows the senses to their objects into the world. And as you follow them to their objects, the objectiveness of the world occurs in one's mind. And so without forcing any kind of an issue, without trying to bend your arm in any kind of a way, you come inside by going out and objectivizing the world. One comes very objectively to the mind. It's like the Zen practice, let a rock be a rock. And if you can find deep aesthetic pleasure in a raked sand garden, then you're well on your way. To what? To being able to enter the mind objectively. If you cut off the senses, sense deprivation, you tend to enter the mind in a fantasy mode. Oh yes, you can enter the mind, but you enter it in a fantasy mode. You have to be really super yogi to be able to work with that. You can. There are disciplines, but frankly, that's... Chogyam Trungpa used to use the English translation for the Tibetan term, Lam Rim is the Tibetan term, and he used to call it crazy wisdom. It takes a crazy wisdom to find the real and fantasy modes. You can. But the time-honored classical wisdom tradition, to use the senses and to focus objectively and accurately on the objects, because it's your accurate focusing on the objective world that allows for an objective mind presence to occur. This is the very essence of the procedure of science. This is why yoga is a science. There's an art of living, but there's a science of being. So it's scientific in this sense that the more that you can objectively see the world as it is, in its objectness, even though it's in terms of your sensation, even though it's conditioned by your seeing, conditioned by your hearing, conditioned by sense, that objectiveness of the world allows you to be present in your mind in an objective way. And by being in your mind objectively, you can objectively view the mind as an object. You can become a viewer of you who thinks. You can observe yourself thinking. And this is called, in the classic Upanishadic self, the understanding. Behind the mind is the understanding. And from this level of understanding, you can objectively see the entire shape of the mind and all of its process functioning as a formation. And the mind becomes capable of being designated as the mind. Instead of it being a subjective, fantasy mode, all-encompassing envelope, it becomes quite objective. It is protean, is fantastic, is limited, has its limitations, has realms where it doesn't work anymore. When I was younger, the phrase that got to me is like a jet engine. As long as there's an atmosphere, it works fantastically well. And if you go above the atmosphere, it doesn't work at all. The understanding is able to objectivize the mind as a whole so that one can understand. I am not my mind. Whatever I am, I can express myself through my mind, but I am not my mind. One of the great jittery threats in this world of evil is that if you don't follow these directions, you're going to we're going to make you lose your mind and take away your mind. Or we're going to condition your mind, and therefore we're going to have you. There's a flaw in that. There's a structural, fatal flaw in that, fortunately. But the understanding itself, that capacity, is not enough. It's not enough to be able to think about the thinker. It's not enough to see you seeing. It's not enough. If that, we'll wait for the machines.